We're in lesson number 25 in the book of 1 Samuel, and we are in chapter number 14. Now, we started in 14 in our last lesson, and we began the story of the secret plan of Saul's son, Jonathan. So the plan of Jonathan was to sneak over to the camp of the Philistines, and because they needed to get some information. But it's a secret plan because Jonathan did not tell his father, the king, what he was going to do. And of course, this is not the first time for this. If you remember, Jonathan actually went over to the garrison of Gibeah and fought against the Philistines. And that's what caused this whole uproar to happen when Jonathan conquered the garrison at Geba. And the Philistines came back with a vengeance and have come back huge army in four different places. And so Jonathan has got this plan to where he's going to come back, he's going to sneak over, and he's going to spy out the camp, and actually he's going to put out a fleece, by the way, just like Gideon did. He's going to put out a fleece, and the Lord's going to answer him. The Lord's going to protect him. He's going to take care of him, so don't worry about Jonathan. But Jonathan did not tell the king about, his father, about this plan. And he did not tell the soldiers who were with him about this plan. And we had talked about, up until this point, three things that we knew had been going on. Number one is it mentioned Saul's hometown, and that Saul was outside of that hometown somewhere under this pomegranate of Migron. Well, we don't even know where Migron is, whether it's north, south, east, west, northwest, southwest. You know, we don't know where it is. It's around someplace, but surely the people who the days of the kings and all the way through the Old Testament, they knew where this pomegranate tree was, and that's the reason why it was recorded in the book. Second thing that comes to mind that we talked about was that Saul had not recouped his warriors. The scripture told us that he only had 600 with him. He had 2,000, but only 600 were with him at the time. The next thing that we learned was that when the writer says to us, and the people did not know that Jonathan had gone, he was indicating to us that Jonathan was acting completely on his own, except for his faithful companion, his lone best friend, probably his armor bearer. So Jonathan was truly stepping out on his own without the approval of the king, his father, and without the knowledge of the other Israelites who were with him, the warriors who were with him, probably about 1,000 there, as he was going to sneak out and go to the camp of at the pass of Mizpah. So fourth, as we pick up where we left off, we are told that Jonathan found his station to spy on the camp of the Philistines, and it was located at the pass of Michmash. Now, he stationed himself on a crag that the Israelites would nickname Bozez. Okay, or Boaz. B-O-Z-E-Z, however you want to pronounce it. A crag, by the way, is a rock protrusion that hangs out over a steep ravine or a valley. It allows a person to go out on the edge of that perch and look straight down and see everything, kind of even back a little ways, and then everything out in front of them. And so this nickname, B-O-Z-E-Z, means shining. The valley or the pass of Michmash runs almost perfectly east to west. We know where this is. And for Jonathan to get to the spot where he could see the camp of the Philistines in the pass, he had to traverse the mountains. He had to climb around. And the mountains had a protruding rock that they're going to nickname B-O-Z-E-Z, Bozez, however you want to pronounce it, okay? He most likely called it that nickname because once he was stationed on the rock, he was probably in the shining sun during the day, because that's what that name means, the shining. So it was shining in some way, form, or fashion. So moving to the new location on that same mountain, he just moved over, there was another protruding rock, another crank, which allowed Jonathan to see the Philistine camp from a different viewpoint. He nicknamed that rock, he nicknamed it S-E-N-E-H, which means acacia, which is better known as a little thorn tree. Now, we've heard about acacia a lot. It had thorns. Now, the protruding rock must have been a little thorn, must have had little thorn trees growing out on the rock. And the writer tells us that one of these protruding rocks was on the north opposite Michmash, and the other was on the south opposite Geba. So he's on this mountain, he's looking out on two different protruding rock areas. However, in our Western mindset, you know, it would just been easier if the writer would have said that he was on one rock that was south of Michmash and he was on another rock that was north of Michmash. One looking south, looking east, one looking west, all that kind of stuff. The word, by the way, for opposite means the opposite direction. When the writer tells us that one protruding rock was on the north opposite Michmash, it actually means that it was to the south of the rock, opposite the north, which would be the south. Now, it's the same thing with Geba. When it says it's the rock opposite Geba, it means it's actually to the north, opposite the south. It's to the north of Geba, which would be the opposite of Geba. All right. So that's kind of confusing, but just take it from our word, okay? So from Jonathan's position on the mount where these two protruding rocks were located, Michmash was to the south, Geba was to the north. There we've got it. That's how easy it is, all right? Explained. The passage says, between the passes by which Jonathan sought to cross over to the Philistines' garrison, there was a sharp crank. We need to address what the writer meant by telling us that there were passes by which Jonathan sought to cross over to the Philistine garrison. There must have been at least two passes or two ways to get to where the Philistines were at these pass, okay? Pass of Michmash. That's what he's trying to tell us, okay? And as Jonathan is looking out over these two crags, that would allow him to determine how best to get close to the garrison camp. Many passes may have been available, more than two, maybe a dozen, different directions, you never know, to get into the spot. And they may have been viewable, okay, from these two different crags, these two different juts out on the rock, but we're not given those details. What we are told is that they were the passes by which Jonathan sought to cross, which meant there were at least two passes, if not more. From the two crags, Jonathan was able to survey the camp of the Philistines from a distance. He knew that he needed to get closer to the camp, down where he could actually hear the voices of the Philistines. The crags allowed him to select the pass in the ravine that would be the best choice to get him to his spying planned area. Where's he going to go? It was time for the show, folks. He had a plan. He knew where he was going. He had conversed with his armor bearer. He knew what he wanted to do, and here's what he said in verse number 6. Then Jonathan said to the young man who was carrying his armor, "Come and let us cross over to the garrison of the uncircumcised. Perhaps the Lord will work for us, for the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few." His armor bearer said to him, "Do all that is in your heart. Turn yourself, and here I am with you according to your desire." Then Jonathan said, "Behold, we will cross over to the men and reveal ourselves to them." To get to the garrison from the current position, Jonathan and his armor bearer needed to cross over to that garrison. Cross over? What were they crossing over? Read nothing extraordinary into these words. It simply meant that Jonathan and his armor bearer had to move closer to the camp by traversing down from the mountains into the pass of Michmash. They had to get down To do that, the armor bearer was more than willing to join in the task with his master. Now, interestingly here, Jonathan called the Philistines uncircumcised. It is a title of reproach, by the way. It's a title of reproach for all Israelites. To be uncircumcised meant that an Israelite was totally out of the will of God. What Jonathan was saying in this passage was that the Philistines were totally out of the will of God as they camped there at the pass of Michmash. They were in the promised land that did not belong to them. The land belonged to the tribes of Israel. It was promised to the Israel since the days of Abraham. How dare the Philistines try to take it for their own land? Now notice, if you will, that Jonathan said, "Perhaps the Lord will work for us, for the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few." Jonathan does not know for sure if the Lord will help him and his armor bearer, but he is sure of one thing. The Lord does not need an army to rescue his people. He can use a few to do the job of an army, or he can use a lot to do the job of an army. To that, Jonathan has spoken correctly. In my time in the ministry of almost 50 years, I have been amazed that in every church there seems to be an older man, who holds no position on the staff, who holds no position on a committee, who is never verbose in his speaking. He is never loud. He is never proud. He is never first to speak. In fact, he's always seems to be the last to speak. In addition, he seems to always be small in stature, not large like I am. He waits. He ponders. He watches. He listens. Then at just the right time, when all else has been said and done, he stands to his feet and quietly states his thoughts quickly and succinctly. In less than a moment, less than a minute, a moment's a minute, he has made his point. Once he spoke, it did not matter what all the rest of the people had said and done. Not one thing. It did not matter the position of the pastor. It did not matter the position of the staff. It did not matter the position of committee members or even anyone in the congregation who had spoken. Their positions were dead in the water unless they agreed with this one man's words. When the vote was taken, the vote always was swayed by his statement. In essence, he was the least in the congregation, but the greatest among all the leaders. Greatest among all the leaders and all the people. He was a true elder in every sense of the biblical word of how it is used in the Word of God. Never is the word elder used in any other connotation. A pastor cannot be an elder simply because he is voted to be the pastor. The pastor was to be selected from in the New Testament. The pastor was to be selected from the men in the congregation who were already the natural elders of the people by their status among the people without any forced approval by man. Neither will Paul instruct Timothy or Titus to create elders in the New Testament church by making them leaders in the church. Rather, Paul instructed Timothy and Titus to select the pastors and the staff from those men who were already proven godly older elders among the people. Older men full of wisdom. Men who in their lives exhibited certain qualifications. But they were never younger men. They were always proven men. In the same way, when Moses needed help judging the people in the wilderness journey, the Lord instructed Moses to choose the judges from the men who were already recognized as older, wiser, elders among the people. Being selected for a position as judge did not give them the title of an elder. If they were not already viewed by the people as natural leaders, they were not going to be selected as a judge. If they were true elders, then Moses would consider them. True elders do not gain authority by a vote of the people, or by being selected, or by being chosen. True elders gain authority through their lifelong time of integrity. If we were to read aloud into the pages of the New Testament, or read ahead into the pages of the New Testament, it would become evident that when an elder system of leadership is put in place, at first it might work very well, but soon it will break down and begin making decisions out of the will of God. Just look at the elder system of the Sanhedrin, where elder positions were passed on from father to son through inheritance, or were purchased by great sums of money from a sitting elder in need of money, or who did not have an heir to pass it on to. So, too, in every congregation where elders have been erroneously established to run the church instead of the authority in the under-shepherd, the God-ordained, God-called, proven pastor of the church, through the years, the elder system becomes corrupt, destroying the lives of good men in the service of the Lord and damaging innocent family members and children. I cannot think of one elder system in one church where decisions were made that forever caused the young people to love Jesus but to hate the organized church. In the Old Testament days, this too was the cause with the young people. Or was the case with the young people. The Lord rarely used groups to direct His congregations, be it in the nation of Israel or in the New Testament church. He always used a few. For this, Jonathan's words are forever correct, true, and trustworthy. Finally, Jonathan told his armor bearer that once they were at the edge of the Philistine camp, the two would reveal themselves to the enemy. To be down there, two people, two Jews, to reveal them to a huge camp of Philistines, it is a dangerous plan. But Jonathan does not present his dangerous plan without some specific options. He gives the first option for it. If the Lord disapproves of being at the edge of the camp of Philistines, so in other words, he's going to give this first option. If the Lord doesn't want him there, this is what's going to happen, verse number 9 of chapter 14. If they say to us, wait until we come to you, then we will stand in our place and not go up to them. Okay. You may not readily recognize it with this first option, but by the time we get the second one, you will. But I'm going to tell you about it anyway. Jonathan has designed a plan almost exactly like the plan of Gideon and his fleece that we learned about over in the book of Judges. In this first option, Jonathan and his armor bearer would reveal themselves to the Philistines and they would wait for their reply. Their reply would in turn reveal God's plan to Jonathan based on Jonathan's predetermined response from the Philistines. So the first option would tell Jonathan that God disapproves of the plan to attack the garrison with just him and his armor bearer alone. Okay? If they say, wait, we'll come to you, forget it. All bets are off. It's not God's will. Now, then we are presented with Jonathan's second option, where the Lord is going to approve of the plan. Verse number 10. But if they say, come up to us, then we will go up. For the Lord has given them into our hands, and this shall be the sign to us. Okay. In this option, the reply of the Philistines will indicate that the Lord approves of Jonathan's plan and will bring victory over the Philistines, even with only two men, two Jews, fighting against the many, many Philistines that are there. Well, Jonathan and his armor bearer move into place, and they reveal themselves to the Philistines as we read on, and we come to the choice of these options, okay? We've got two options. The Philistines will reveal God's plan according to their own words as pre-planned by Jonathan, verse number 11. And when both of them revealed themselves to the Philistines said, behold, Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden themselves. So the men of the garrison hailed Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, come up to us and we will tell you something. Jonathan's second option was inadvertently chosen by the Philistines. The fleece placed before the Lord by Jonathan was answered. But the Philistines' answer also revealed something else about their knowledge of the Israelite army. They knew that a huge portion of Saul's army had hidden in the holes when they learned of the approaching Philistine army. How did they know? We do not know. But no doubt, just as Jonathan had spied out the garrison of the Philistines had spied out the garrison of Saul at Gilgal, and they saw the men running for their lives. What's a garrison? I guess we should have answered that before. We would like to say that it is a fort. We'd like to say it's a fortified stronghold of some kind where the soldiers were safe and protected from their enemies. We'd like to call that a garrison. But when this word was used in the English translation, the word garrison simply meant a place where the army camped. It did not mean a fortified place. The sheer number of soldiers in the camp was thought to be its protection and its stronghold. However, these camp locations where they would sit would usually be carefully selected because they're going to be out in the open. No enemy could attack from above. The camp members had plenty of ways to escape in different directions if enemies came to the camp. And as such, the campsite was a protected location, even though it had no walls, it had no stone, it had no gates, it had no bars, it had no moats, it had no drawbridges, as we tend to think of a garrison today. Well, when Jonathan hears the confirmation of the choice of the option, we hear of Jonathan's answer and the calamity of the option, verse number 12b. And Jonathan said to his armor bearer, come up after me, for the Lord has given them into the hands of Israel. Jonathan's unsurety of his plan has become the surety of his plan. He did not question the answer of the Philistines. He did not second guess or doubt his plan for one moment. He heard the answer. To him, it was God's answer spoken through the lips of his enemies. To him, it was his sign to attack. And thus we come to the slaughter of the Philistines by the hands of Jonathan and his armor bearer in verse number 13. Then Jonathan climbed up on his hands and feet with his armor bearer behind him, and they fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer put some to death after him. That first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor bearer made was about 20 men within half a fur in an acre of land. And there was a trembling in the camp, in the field, and among the people. Even the garrison and the raiders trembled, and the earth quaked, so that it became a great trembling. Evidently, Jonathan and his armor bearer were crouched down out of sight. But then they rose to their feet and attacked, killing about 20 men in half a fur of an acre of land. What does all that mean? Well, the Hebrew does not say in an acre of land. It says, really, truly, the translation is in a yoke of land. So being about a half of a fur or a half of a yoke of land means that the distance that an ox can plow in a field, get this, in about a half a day. So a fur is a trench created by the plow, which causes the dirt to pile up into a raised bed. So a team of oxen could plow a yoke of land in the morning and a yoke of land in the evening. And you might say that it was about an acre, but it might not actually be an acre, it could be less. The amount of land that could be plowed in the morning was determined by several factors, such as the kind of soil, the overgrowth, the soil, what kind of, was it rocky, whatever. Was it grassy? Nevertheless, whatever amount the oxen could plow in a morning was called a yoke of land. And get this, it had more to do with what was accomplished in the morning, not the amount that was accomplished. For Jonathan and his armor bearer, they killed about 20 men in the length of a fur, created in a normal day, half day's work with a team of oxen and a plow. And the sudden attack frightened the Philistines. But then the trembling of the earth frightened them even more. And the trembling of the earth was not the act of Jonathan or his armor bearer. Folks, it was the act of God.